I'm Greg Johnson.
And I'm John Morgan.
I'm Michael Polignano.
Welcome to Countercurrents Radio. Our guest this week is Jason Kessler, the organizer of Unite the Right. Unite the Right was last August. It was a protest, a rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, against taking down a Confederate memorial in the city, but, you know, more broadly, because that has been a trend around the country. And the consequences of Unite the Right, well, Unite the Right itself descended into chaos, basically, and violence. The Antifa attacked people. The police stood down. The rally was shut down by the state government and so forth. And then after that, there's been a lot of legal drama and battles and challenges. And I talked to Jason recently about this, and I wanted to bring him on the show because I thought that these lawsuits that are raging have a great deal of potential for good or ill, because how they are decided will set precedents that will affect freedom of speech and freedom of assembly in the United States for future events. So, Jason, welcome to the show.
Good to be with you.
Yeah, so could you give us a little recap? You don't need to start the clock at Charlottesville 1.0 or everything like that, but give us a little bit of recap about Charlottesville, and then tell us a bit about the suits, who the parties to these suits are, and so forth.
Yeah, so Unite the Right is, as you described it, it was a huge, huge event that made international news, and it was basically declared an unlawful assembly. We didn't get to do our demonstration, and there was a lot of violence afterwards. So in the days afterwards, we started dealing with the fallout. It was a very nerve-wracking time for me, because I had the entire world press attacking me and saying false things about me. And my friends were constantly being charged with different things. Chris Cantwell got charged with some outrageous, you know, use of tear gas or something. He just used some pepper spray. And a number of other people got charged in the incident with this guy, DeAndre Harris. And it was just crazy. I didn't know what kind of things were going to come down on me. Eventually, the city ended up creating a lawsuit in conjunction with these area businesses that are really upset that they've lost revenue and so forth. So they're trying to get an injunction to keep us from being able to hold any further rallies. There were two other lawsuits filed for monetary damages, and these were people who were claiming that they'd either been injured somehow, like maybe they got struck by James Field's car, or in some cases they're just saying, you know, I'm emotionally damaged because I'm a Jewish person living in Charlottesville, and now I feel like my synagogue is going to be firebombed and I need some money. So there are all various reasons for why people are trying to sue. And only these two lawsuits were served to me. And that was kind of a weird experience, because I had to change my address after August 12th. And then I have these people coming banging on the doors at all hours. I don't know what it's for. It's been intense. And that's where we are right now. Is I'm fighting these two lawsuits, trying to go on the offense, where I initiate my own lawsuits against the city for civil rights violations, and hoping that my friends don't get charged or convicted of these crimes that the Charlottesville government is trying to convict them of.
That's interesting. So in terms of the lawsuits that you have had served against you, who are the co-defendants in those lawsuits, and who are the plaintiffs in those lawsuits, just to get clear?
Well, the one that the Charlottesville government did in conjunction with these area businesses is more straightforward. That one is the various liberal businesses. It's not like a wide ideological spread of business owners. It's pretty much businesses that are owned by activists, and they're claiming all kinds of things. There's one business that I hadn't even heard of. I think it's a hair salon, and they're saying that somebody sent them a letter, which was like a troll letter, if you think of the kinds of things that, you know, Andrew Anglin's fans might have sent to Tanya Gersh or something. That's the kind of thing this person was claiming to have received. And I'd never heard of this business. I don't know who else had heard of this business. I think they might have just mailed this letter to themselves so that they could claim victim status and get in a lawsuit, because the letter itself was really over the top. Then the other lawsuit, which is seeking monetary damages, is a whole lot of people. I don't remember all of them, but there are a few Jane and John Does, which are unnamed people. There's an individual named Seth Wispelwee, who is part of this clergy collective in Charlottesville, which is a really insidious and subversive organization of basically communist clergy. They use their pulpit to push for social justice. So there's several of these clergy collective people who were never hurt, but they're claiming emotional distress. I think that there's a few people who were injured by James Field's car, allegedly. So they're claiming the physical damages. There's some guy who was at the August 11th torch march who claims that he was struck with a torch and had a stroke or something and hasn't been able to work the same since. I mean, none of this stuff is really related to me. I didn't hit any of these people with torches. I didn't drive a car into anybody. I didn't send anybody any letters. So they really don't have grounds to sue me. But then again, look, I mean, they're putting all kinds of people. They're putting David Duke on the lawsuit. They're putting Ameren on the lawsuit. No one at Ameren had anything to do with this event. So they're just in general trying to go after what could be described as pro-white activists and organizations.
So would you describe this as a nuisance lawsuit, as just a harassment lawsuit? Because it sounds like a lot of the stuff in there is spurious. For instance, they claim that these two police officers in the helicopter crash were somehow connected to Unite the Right because it happened around the same time. I imagine, you know, if some guy starts going bald around the time of Unite the Right, he's going to come and say, these people scared the hair follicles out of my head or something. I mean, it just sounds utterly frivolous and really as just a grab bag of frivolous claims that are just there to harass you. And do frivolous harassment suits like this advance in the courts? Isn't there some mechanism for striking down this?
Yes and no. I mean, you can't go like Richard Spencer is going and saying, you know, I can't find an attorney, please have mercy on me. They're not going to have mercy. This is a frivolous lawsuit, but it's backed up by some very powerful people. One of the lawyers argued before the Supreme Court in the case that struck down the gay marriage ban, for instance. So these are people with a lot of experience. There's a ton of money behind these people. I mean, these are massive law firms, some of them from Washington, D.C., that are used to dealing with political cases. You have to make your argument.
So can you tell me a bit about some of these lawyers and other backers? Are the usual suspects involved groups like the ADL or the SPLC, or is it more local, ultra-left, cultural Marxist types? What percentage of these people's names echo that kind of stuff? I'd be very curious as to the makeup of the people who are pushing these lawsuits.
I haven't scrutinized them all individually. I do know that there's several Jewish litigators. I do know that there's a mix of local law firms and out-of-area law firms. I think Georgetown Law is one of the organizations that's involved with this. Let's see. Like I said, there's that attorney with the Supreme Court experience. This is definitely an activist lawsuit. Kyle Bristow described it on Twitter as creative litigation, and that's what it is. It's something that they don't really have precedent for, but they're trying to use it to create precedent. So essentially what they're arguing when they're trying to get an injunction to keep us from holding any more rallies is to say this group of people is so bad that they should not be allowed to have First, Second, or 14th Amendment rights anymore. And it's for the city of Charlottesville, but you better believe that if they were successful with this lawsuit, it would be a precedent that would be cited all around the country for alt-right, for militia people. You know, I mean, they'd trot this thing out to stop any political dissidents from having their First Amendment rights.
So basically, they want to see how far they can push this and what they can get away with.
Yeah. And it's also lawfare. It's legal warfare. So they're trying to bankrupt us, essentially. They're trying to see what the limits of our financial capabilities are, because even though it's this so-called creative legislation and it is a nuisance lawsuit, if people can't afford to hire attorneys, they lose by default. You get a judgment rendered against you de facto. This isn't like criminal court where you are entitled to a public defender. If you get a lawsuit filed against you by these powerful people with lots of money and you have no money to hire an attorney, then you're screwed.
So what in the blazes is Richard Spencer thinking by saying, I can't find a lawyer, have mercy on me? Is that a tactic that has worked in the past? What's he counting on here?
Well, on the one hand, his argument in that letter seems to be a good argument as far as, you know, this is a nuisance lawsuit and it's just trying to bankrupt political dissidents and so forth. But no, I don't think it's a tactic that would work. Maybe if this were not a politically charged case, if it didn't have international exposure, if it wasn't being litigated by these powerful attorneys from Washington, D.C., yeah, maybe a judge would have mercy, but they're not going to have mercy on you in this case. You have to have a lawyer. And I don't think that he's thinking in terms of this is the best strategy for me. I think he's just sort of burned his bridges with people who acted more responsibly about this, like myself. I mean, I went ahead and I was taking this very seriously from the beginning and calling people through the darkest days after August 12th, when the world was coming down around me, I put my feet on the ground and I started working. And at first I called various attorneys that were supposed to be civil rights, free speech attorneys, and they wanted $150,000 to $400,000 up front. And I knew there was no way. I mean, I'd heard that Andrew Anglin and the Stormer had raised about $150,000, but as I tried to bring people together to create some kind of fundraising mechanism that would be able to do that, I just saw maybe some other time, not right now. I mean, nobody was listening to each other. No one except me was taking the lawsuit seriously. Fortunately, Matt Parrott from TWP had a contact in Ohio, and that was my current attorney now, Jim Kalinick. And Jim was able to work out something much more reasonable with me, that I could pay monthly, and, you know, he expects to win. So he's going to take a percentage of the back end when we win. And that works for me. But other people weren't doing that. Like, people like Richard Spencer were focused on going to these college campuses and doing interviews with these major media organizations and just not really doing the groundwork, which is, it's not glamorous. You know, you don't get a whole lot of media exposure doing it, but it's got to be done.
So it wasn't so much that he couldn't find a lawyer, it's that he just didn't want to spend the time or the money finding a lawyer. Couldn't he use your lawyer? Couldn't he partner up with you guys, so with TWP and with Jason Kessler, and get this lawyer to help him out with his own legal troubles?
I mean, he could have. It seems to be some kind of obstinance on his part where he's still running with this narrative that he was so offended by this tweet I put out about Heather Heyer that one time that he'll never work with me again. And I mean, that's to his discredit, because I am one of the hardest working people in this movement and I get things done. So yeah, I mean, there was a point where he could have used my attorney, but now my attorneys are too bogged down. There was a point where we would have preferred to have everybody on the same legal team, because then we could have had it moved from state to federal court, and it should be in federal court because it's dealing with constitutional issues like the First Amendment, Second Amendment, 14th Amendment.
Mm-hmm.
But that time passed because there were a few clients who didn't want to get on board, and I guess that was Spencer and then the militia people. The militia people don't want to be associated with us, and they keep saying that they're going to find an attorney, but they can't find one. So basically, we're stuck in state court for right now. But I mean, I could still help him find an attorney. He hasn't been particularly nice to me since this whole thing has started. But if he came and said, I'm sorry about disavowing you publicly to the media and, you know, trying to bury you essentially, you know, my bad. Can you help me out? I would probably put him in touch with my attorneys so that they could find somebody for him, but he doesn't seem willing to do that.
Interesting. So let me ask you, how has this Eli Mosley story broken by the New York Times affected any of this? Has it had any effect on it?
It's hard to tell. I haven't had a chance to speak with my attorneys about this. I mean, there's some areas of the way things play out in court that the attorneys are going to know that I won't. I mean, to me, it doesn't seem like it's going to be a huge deal, but it does seem like they're trying to force a meta narrative. I mean, by they, I mean, you know, the liberal establishment, the media are trying to force this narrative that we are false and were not truthful to discredit us prior to this trial, because I think they know that if we win this trial, it's going to be huge for our movement and it's going to be crippling to people's trust in the media.
Right. So has Identity Europa been named as one of the defendants as well?
Yeah, and Identity Europa is on the legal team.
Oh, okay, so they're cooperating with you. That's interesting. And Mosley, who was he acting in concert with when he was involved with this thing? Was he working with Richard Spencer? Was he working with Identity Europa? Was he a freelance person? It's not clear what his connections or status was.
Yeah, he was a high-ranking member of Identity Europa, and he was working with Spencer. The line between Identity Europa and Spencer is very thin, you know.
Well, at that time it was, yeah, definitely.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know how it's going to affect it. I mean, he was one of the co-organizers, but really, I mean, I was doing most of the planning for about 2 months, mm-hmm. and then I had a few guys who were doing the on-the-ground stuff, mm-hmm. and he is one of the people who filled in for the on-the-ground stuff.
Mm-hmm. What is the timeline for this now? Like, how soon can you expect to actually go to court or... You know, what's the situation with that? Is it something that's going to be settled this year, or is this going to be something that might drag on for a long time?
Well, it's difficult to say. As a whole, the legal battle with Charlottesville is probably going to take 2 years, maybe 3 years. But the lawsuits wow. against me may have a very short life because we've filed a motion to dismiss or demur on both of these lawsuits. They both have similar issues. For instance, these complaints that they filed against me are like a rambling screed, and that's what my attorneys call them. They're like 140 pages, and they just treat me like I'm Lucifer incarnate. They're very dishonest in how they portray things, but ultimately, in 140 pages, they never cite a civil statute under which they have authority to sue me. They make up all these BS criminal allegations. They say improper militia formations and assuming the authority of a police. The people, the militias who came weren't even part of the rally. Militias have been part of Virginia forever. You're legally allowed to open carry in Virginia. And besides that, I personally wasn't doing any of that stuff. You know, I just came to do my speeches. So their grounds to sue me are extremely dubious if they can't even cite a civil statute under which they have authority to make that motion. But, you know, that being said, this is Charlottesville. This is a very political case. The judge has wide discretion, so even if there's no authority for them to be able to do this lawsuit, the judge might say, I want to hear it anyway. So we'll see. That gets into the creative legislation aspect of it.
Basically,
and that'll be ruled on next month.
So basically, they're just hoping that all the outrage over this is going to push it through, regardless of whatever legal precedent or lack thereof there is.
Exactly. I mean, they're just trying to demonize me and the Unite the Right participants to such an extent that people's emotions overcome their logic so that somebody like a judge will say, you know, I don't care that they don't have grounds to do this. I hate these people so much that I want it to go forward. And I don't know that the judge is going to do that. He might be good. I've seen some good judicial rulings and some bad judicial rulings here in Charlottesville.
Is there any good news in the legal front? I understand that the people who attacked you when you tried to do your press conference after the Unite the Right have actually been convicted of something. Is that correct?
Yeah, there were 4 convictions from last Monday. And basically what happened is that after that press conference where the people attacked me, there didn't seem to be any momentum towards the police investigating it. The guy who had struck me from behind went on TV and he was reported in the New York Times and the local NBC affiliate as being the person who punched Jason Kessler. So eventually I got tired of it and I went to the magistrate and asked for a warrant. And at that point they said, okay, well, we're not going to do this, but we'll have the police investigate. So the police did identify these people and it was handed off to a special prosecutor from this red county called Augusta, Virginia. And that's essentially why the convictions happened, because anytime the Charlottesville judicial system has these antifas, they let them go. And they tried to sabotage this case too. They didn't do proper booking procedures for the people. The guy, Jeff Winder, who was the one who struck me, he had a tattoo on his arm. So you would think that they would want to take pictures of that in bookings because it's going to be a 100% ID. They didn't bother to do that. And there was one guy who should have been convicted but got off. His name was Kenneth Litzenberger, and he spit on me after the press conference. And the way that Charlottesville sabotaged that was like 24 hours before the case was supposed to start, and it had been in the process for months. The special prosecutor found out that Charlottesville hadn't put in the order to make him the official prosecutor. So if he'd tried to go and argue that case, he could have been committing a crime himself. So Charlottesville ended up getting in the order the day of, but because it really threw a wrench in the case, we ended up just continuing that one for a year. So the guy basically is not going to face any punishment as long as he doesn't get in trouble for a year. But Phoebe Stevens, she's the one who jumped me from behind. She's a teacher at Wilson Memorial High School in Virginia here. She's a French teacher. And she tried to argue that she jumped me because of love. She said she screamed, "I love you, Jason." I mean, but she looked like she was in a football game. She ran as fast as she could and like attacked my knee. Basically, she wrapped her arms around me and pulled me to the ground. So anyway, she was convicted. A local socialist, very skeletal guy named Brandon Collins was convicted. And of course, this Jeff Winder guy.
So what kind of penalty will they actually have to bear for this?
Nothing really. I mean, these people have no criminal record. So that in and of itself is something, is that now they've got a criminal record, an assault charge, and hopefully this Phoebe Stevens lady will lose her job at the high school. I'm trying to get my friends to call this school and say, hey, do you know you have a violent offender at this school? Because I bet that they'll try and cover for her and be like, oh, yeah, she's convicted of a violent crime. And
a love crime.
Normally, we don't allow people in the classroom that way, but we really hate the guy that she attacked, so she can stay. And this is one of the few cases where the bad guys might actually get fired. I mean, they can get us fired any time. All they got to do is say they're racist, and you lose your job. If you call them a communist or anti-white, what have you, I mean, they're like, well, we don't care. But in this case, a teacher is not supposed to have a violent record.
Right.
So that's independent of the other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. And you'd think that teachers should be especially held to the standard of being civilized, right, in dealing with disagreements and so forth, that would be the sort of virtue that would be highly prized in a classroom.
Yeah, definitely. She's a nasty woman. She was trying to talk about creative legal strategies. She was going in there, like I said, and saying that she was after me for my own safety to cover me so that other people wouldn't be able to attack. And she was just going on and on. I'm a yoga instructor and I love kids and I deplore everything that Jason Kessler stands for, but I love him because all people have something special inside And then after she was convicted, I saw her outside the courtroom, and if looks could kill, let me tell you, she was putting on a show in the courtroom, but outside you could tell she hates my guts.
You mean she was lying? She was lying under oath?
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So what is the timetable going forward? When are these things going to hit court? And what are you doing to, raise money, build allies, and things like that?
Well, these cases are already in court. It's just a very slow process that's not necessarily something that people are going to be paying attention to every little detail. I mean, basically, they had to serve me with the papers. And I avoided that. If anybody is trying to sue you, you do like Andrew Anglin did, and you keep them from being able to serve you as long as possible. That buys you more time. And so that's what I did for a little while. But, you know, I'm not in, Lagos, Nigeria. They know where I am, so I couldn't avoid it but so long. After that, they give you a few days. You got to respond. My attorneys responded. We tried to have it moved from state to federal court. That didn't happen, like I said, because we had a few defendants who did not have legal representation and sort of dropped the ball. And now we filed our motions to dismiss, and those should be heard in March. After the cases on the motion to dismiss are heard, we'll move forward with our countersuits, which are going to be the big money items to try and punish Charlottesville for violating our rights. And what we'd really like is to have those motions to dismiss successful, so then we can definitely move it into federal court, because we could do these lawsuits not as countersuits, but just straight up lawsuits, because we wouldn't have to deal with playing defense anymore. As far as raising money, it's been a little bit difficult because of all the people who are so obsessed with me and trying to flag every single project that I do and getting it shut down. When we first started a fundraiser on like Rootbox or GoFundMe or whatever, right after August 12th, I did raise some money out of that. And I've raised some money like from people who write checks to my attorney and so forth, but it's been very difficult with PayPal banning me, Stripe banned me, and these people don't even know who I am. They think that I'm encouraging violence or something, which is not the case. I did find a new venue for raising money, and that's Maker Support. But the trick with the Maker Support is that I can't technically raise money for the lawsuit with that. So it's a fundraiser for my creative works, you know, my YouTube channel, for my investigative journalism and activism. But, you know, I mean, you're helping me out when you do that, for sure. And that's the best way that people can contribute right now. I've also got some t-shirts that are going to be available. I've got several different designs, and those are made by the same people who do the TRS stuff, the Fascination shirts and Paranormies and all that. And I should have that up on my Twitter soon. If you go to my gab.ai/themaddimension, you'll see a link to my Maker Support. It's just Maker Support/Jason_Kessler. I wish it was easier for people to find that, but that one got taken down at first too, because somebody was reporting it, because evidently there's a piece of the terms of services that says you can't raise money for legal efforts on the site. So I contacted Maker Support, and they were pretty cool about it. They said you have to take out all references to the lawsuit, and then we'll put it back up. And they did, but they put it on some kind of locked account for people that are constantly being reported. So even Chris Cantwell doesn't have that on his Maker Support. But for, on mine, you can't see the total amount that's being pledged. And I don't think that you can search my account. So basically, you got to go to that address, which is makersupport.com/Jason_Kessler. You can find the link on my Gab. You can also click the donate button on my website, jasonkessler.us, and that'll give you options for Maker Support and some cryptocurrency options.
Well, great. So tell us a bit about how you envision the potential precedents for freedom of speech and freedom of assembly, not only for the lawsuits that you've been targeted with, but the ones that have come out of Charlottesville in general?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be very important. Obviously, like I was saying, this so-called creative legislation could set a precedent for other rallies. We tried to have a rally in Lee Park, which is a public park, and that's supposed to be one of the most sacred areas for United States citizens to practice their First Amendment rights. It's called a traditional public venue, and really the authorities of any municipality are not supposed to be able to deny people to go there and speak whenever they want to. And then there's some other venues that are a little bit less protected, like if you go on to a public university, it's a semi-public venue. And then when you get down to private property, you really don't have that many rights at all. But they're trying to frame it as if our way of thinking, being pro-white, is inherently evil, inherently violent, and we can no longer be safely accommodated on traditional public venues. So we have to fight that for sure. And it's part of the ongoing thing. Most of the alt-right, civil rights, free speech cases have been on public universities so far. And that's getting to the point where there's enough precedent on that that it's sort of like a slam dunk, basically. It's just a layup. And it's good that those are happening, but we really have to protect our other rights, and we also have to punish these municipalities which are not going to give 14th Amendment protections to people they don't like. So that's equal protection under the law. So in this case, if we want to do a demonstration and Antifa says, well, we are going to use violence to shut down that demonstration, and if the municipality and the cops don't like us, they'll say, have at it, Huss. And that's the end of the rally, because if people are willing to use excessive violence to shut you down, then there's nothing much you can do about that. The authorities will use it to declare unlawful assembly. So what we need to do is punish a municipality like Charlottesville, financially and otherwise, so that they never, ever think about doing something like that again. And Charlottesville really is feeling the pain in a way that most people who are outside of this area probably don't know. And there's some schadenfreude there. These businesses that are trying to throw their political weight around are losing all kinds of money. The Charlottesville name itself is no longer associated with a sleepy college town. It's synonymous with whatever they tried to say in the media, like neo-Nazi, white supremacist violence. So they've really shot themselves in the foot when they could have just protected our rights, kept the side separate, had a controversial rally, but, you know, a rally that was peaceful, and they didn't do that. So we're going to sue them, and we're going to do another rally in August 12th of this year to show them not only is this going to have financial consequences for you, but you're not going to be able to get rid of us that easily. You're eventually going to have to just let us do the rally that we intended to do in the first place.
Right. So there have been findings by objective inquiries about the improper behavior of the local government and the state government in handling Unite the Right. Can you tell us a bit about those findings and how they will impact these legal proceedings?
Oh, yeah, it was a great help, because everything that was going on within the Charlottesville government and the police department was so secretive leading up to this event and afterwards. There was a lockdown. I sent some FOIA requests and got a little bit of information here and there, but there were a lot of details we just didn't know. And the Charlottesville government hired this former federal prosecutor named Tim Heafy to come in and do a review of August 12th and what went wrong. And I didn't know whether it was going to be something that helped keep the Charlottesville government free of legal liability or whether it was going to be truthful. But for the most part, it seemed to be very truthful. The guy is a Democrat, and he solicited the job from the mayor, who is a close personal friend. But that being said, he found all kinds of things that are going to be useful in our case. For instance, the problems with the chief of police, Al Thomas, who was put in that position by Wes Bellamy, because Wes Bellamy, the Afrocentric former vice mayor, wanted to have a black police chief who would look the other way for black crime and be a political operative, essentially. So this guy, he, on the day of the rally, was heard by multiple people saying, let them fight, it will make it easier to declare an unlawful assembly. Now, he denies that, but there, I mean, four or five of his right-hand men and women said that he said that. So I don't see how he gets out of that. It was also clear that there was a culture of silence and intimidation within the police department. There were a number of police officers who said that they felt like the investigation couldn't be done properly with this police chief because he was looking over people's shoulders. He was asking for information about what people were testifying to this federal prosecutor about. And it was also found that he had deleted text messages. He'd lied about using his private email address to plan some elements of the rally. And then he was also fabricating documents after the investigation began to make it seem like he was more prepared than he was. So he went and found these, I guess they're national or federal guidelines for controversial rallies. And there's this checklist that says you're supposed to do this, this, and that. And he went and like had his advisors check all the boxes and provide some other documents that made it seem like he'd gone through this process.
You know, everywhere you look, it just seems there's corruption everywhere. This FISA memo, the mountains and mountains of corruption and impropriety. It's just, it's amazing we haven't lapsed into a complete banana republic at this point, given the low standards and low morals, especially of the left.
Mm-hmm.
It's truly shocking. So let's talk about the rationale for another Charlottesville rally. It doesn't sound like a great idea to me, to be honest, Jason. I mean, I guess on one level, just to get it as a precedent would be a good thing. But in terms of finding people who actually want to participate, does anybody actually want to participate in another Charlottesville, given the terrible consequences? And I don't just mean the violence and everything like that. I mean, that shouldn't have happened. But also the lawsuits that have come along, the deplatforming, the vilification, and so forth. A lot of people lost jobs. The public image stuff.
I have to say, I mean, people among my friends and family who maybe were sympathetic to, you know, what you guys were trying to do in relation to the statue, and even, you know, before August, were at least open-minded about the alt-right, it's a lot more difficult now for me to try to talk to people in a reasonable way about what happened there. And I really wonder if you're going to be able to overcome that, because, you know, the media is going to basically portray it like it's Nuremberg 1934 when you guys go out there. I don't know if you're going to be able to overcome that.
Yeah, I mean, look, as far as how the image of Unite the Right was created in the public mind in the first place, it's something that I think people got to have a little bit of sympathy for, because we're a small dissident movement growing every day. But the other side had PR firms from Washington, D.C., from Richmond, where the governor is. They had the ADL and the SPLC providing narratives for them. They had a compliant media which wanted to sensationalize the event and create this incredibly negative and one-sided image of us. And we can't just be a movement that's online forever. We have to find a way to move into the real world. And I think that Unite the Right really moved us in that direction, where we understand how powerful our enemies are, what they are willing to do, what links they are willing to go to destroy us and make us look bad. And I think people are a little bit less green now. I think there's some behavior issues on our side as far as how people present themselves that folks know better now. So if you're just coming out to these things to be a spurg, maybe you shouldn't come out to that, because your actions are probably going to get you fired from your job or whatever. You know, you got to be well behaved, because this is about victory. It's not about going out like a liberal does and get their emotions heard, like screaming into the sky because of the election of Donald Trump or something. So that's the image that was created about us. Now, the rationale for doing another one, I mean, of course, I started out at a position where I was like, well, that was the furthest thing from my mind. Why would you ever want to try and do this again with all the risks and the consequences? And then the idea came to me that I should at least put in a permit for August 12th, 2018, because you know how politics work. You know how political theater works. They're going to have a media cycle on August 12th, which is further demonizing us, which is going to hold up people like Heather Heyer and DeAndre Harris as martyrs for the cause against the scourge of racism. And I said, you know what? I want to reserve that park because I don't want them to be able to dance on our graves on the anniversary of this rally. And then as I started thinking about it, I thought, actually, there is a way to do this. And it's actually something that we need to do. First of all, it's because of the precedent, as you say, you cannot back down to these people. I mean, if they think that the tactics that they used to shut us down last year work, they're just going to keep doing that. And there's no doubt in my mind that it's not the same thing to say, well, we're going to do a rally in Shelbyville or New Orleans or Boston or wherever you can think. If we do not go back to Charlottesville, we're essentially slinking away. And that's something that they will continue to do. They'll keep bashing us in some area until we just say, screw it. We don't even want to go out into the streets. The other thing is to recontextualize the narrative about Charlottesville. There are very few moments when you're able to capture the national and international media attention and be the primary focus. Unite the Right was one of those moments. Everything else that is published about the alt-right is pretty much in the background. It's like white noise. You know, sure, they might publish a piece on us in the New York Times or here or there every once in a while, but it's not blaring in red headlines on every major news site. It's not the primary thing. Like, for instance, the Mueller investigation and the corruption the FBI is right now. So when these reports come out, like the Tim Heafy report showing that we weren't to blame on August 12th, they're like, eh, that's nice. We'll write an article for thehill.com, but we'll bury it somewhere so only the people who are actually in your movement and are sharing it on Facebook will see it. So people are always going to have this fake impression that it was these evil neo-Nazis who came to beat up POC. And that's just false. And so by doing another rally, it will be controversial. The media will want to do what they do, but they'll have to provide context in the sense that this Heafy report came out and showed that the police had the stand down order and were completely corrupt and inept. They'll have to acknowledge the lawsuit that I'm going to file against the city for this and sort of cast doubt on that initial narrative. And that is so invaluable because this moment for us in Charlottesville is sort of what Birmingham was to the Black Civil Rights Movement. It's never going to just fade away. It's never going to be, oh yeah, that's in the rearview mirror now. Like, this is the ground we have to fight on. This is going to go down in the history books, and it's not over yet. By going back, we get to keep writing on this story. And so finally, there's the aspect about, well, if you go back, don't you expect the same thing to happen? They're going to portray you as terrorists and monsters and all that stuff. Well, there's a number of reasons I believe we can do this differently. Number one, I don't think that we're going to have the same turnout as we did last time, because there are going to be plenty of people who are scared. There are going to be people who maybe weren't in this thing for the right reasons before, like they wanted to come and act out or something. So I don't think we're going to have that. I think we're going to have a smaller group of people, probably like maybe 300 people that are the most dedicated individuals, and we can focus on making those individuals disciplined. And we're not going to do any last minute decisions to do a torch rally. Everything is going to be clearly planned in advance. We're not going to have a situation where the permit decision is made 7 p.m. the night before the rally. My attorneys are going to get the permit thing squared out months in advance, so everybody knows we have a permit. We're going to make the police put their plans public so that everybody knows what to expect. And then lastly, I think there's a strategic issue, which I did not understand at the time I was doing the first Unite the Right. I didn't understand the dynamics of crowd control, but you can't have all these different people coming to your rally from all over the place and just say, show up whenever. There are a lot of folks who will come and be outnumbered by Antifas in that situation. They'll get isolated and attacked. That's a situation where people end up overreacting and perhaps get themselves into criminal trouble. So what we got to do is we got to have a rally point that is within marching distance of the park. We want to get there hours in advance. We want the police and the National Guard to be there with us so that when we show up, we're not going to be walking into a trap, right? If the police aren't there, then we know it's a problem and we're not going in. We wait for the police to come and the National Guard to come. Then I think that we need a more distributed leadership. I think that there were too many egos at the first one where there was a small clique of people, you know, in the white polos club, basically, who thought that they could do it all themselves and not communicate with other people. So I think you really have to unite the right in a real way, appoint captains from different organizations who are responsible for the behavior of their members, appoint captains who are responsible for the behavior of any people from the general public who happen to come, and get everybody in a big marching column. Nobody has got some kind of inflammatory shit like a swastika flag. If they've got that, they're booted or they got to throw it away. Then make sure everybody is well versed on the behavior protocol. You are not to get into fights with anybody. I expect that the Antifas will be kept behind barricades this time. And whatever the case might be, I'm sure the police will be much more invested in keeping us and them separated if they are the ones who are going to be marching with us. I don't think that they want to get attacked by Antifa either. So then we would march into the park, we would hold a free speech rally, and then we would all leave together back to the rally point. People get in their cars and leave. So there's really no opportunity for that kind of violence. We're going to be able to screen people in the hours that we have at the rally point beforehand to make sure they're not in possession of anything that's too provocative. I think that we're going to really hone the optics so that even the group flags, we'll probably just do away with those and have American and Confederate flags only. And I think that the shock in the media, no matter that they're trying to demonize us, when they see these people look very different than the, I don't know, like warrior people that we presented ourselves as last time with American flags and Confederate flags, the optics are just going to be too good. And the disparity between how we look and how resonant the things we are saying are with the media's portrayal of us is really going to be jarring for people. So that's my rationale for it.
Who is going to participate in this with you? Have you already lined up some groups to come along and to take part?
Yeah, I've talked to just about everybody who was involved the first time. Not everybody, but I'm really not twisting any arms right now because we're so far out and I want to get the permit issue dealt with. I didn't really start the last Unite the Right until 3 months beforehand. So we've got 6 months right now. And once we file our lawsuit to have the permit instated, I think that's going to instill a little bit more confidence in people. Then, if and when we do win that case, which I expect to, and our permit is instated, that's going to bring a little bit more confidence to people. And then I start having serious conversations with people about like what kinds of safety and security precautions do you require to feel comfortable going into this atmosphere? And then we start putting that to our lawyer. The lawyer gives it to the police and we make sure that everything is verified and on the up and up. And by that point, I'm going to have a lot of confidence in this process. I think everybody else will too, and I'll start doing the rounds You know, I'll go on our media. I'll go on mainstream media if I have to, and I'll really start doing a hard sell. Right now, I don't need to do a hard sell because I want to be able to tell people 100% that we've got this, it's safe, and all that. I don't know that yet. I mean, there's so many unknowns. So once I'm able to honestly promise people that this will be safe and it will be worthwhile, then I'm going to start selling it.
Okay, well, that sounds very well thought out. The Antifa, though, are going to have an equal amount of time to plan for this. What are you anticipating from the enemy?
Obviously, their frenzy is going to be taken up a notch because now they're starting to go with this narrative that the alt-right killed Heather Heyer, and they're trying to go around and say, well, more people are killed by white supremacists than any other group, even Islamic terrorists, blah, blah, blah. So they're trying to justify ratcheting up their violence. They're trying to justify murder. So that's an issue that's going to be there, not just for my rally, but any rally, any public rally. I mean, that's a scary thing, but ultimately you can't back down. That's what they want you to do, is back down. It's worked in the past. It's worked with pro-white groups in the past where the Antifa elements used violence and people said, oh, fuck this, it's not worth it to me. And their movement fell apart. So there's no struggle for rights, for territory, for God, for country that's ever happened where people didn't have to face risks. And I'm prepared to take those risks. I know a lot of other people are prepared to take those risks because you have to have fighters. You have to have people who are willing to put it all on the line. And that being said, I have to work to try and create the safest environment I possibly can for people. And the number one thing is making sure that the police agree to keep these people behind the barricades. It was very foolish of the city government to try and demand that the Antifa had a right to occupy half of the park last time. That's not the case. When you look at the precedents that have been set in the abortion clinic protests, the abortion clinic protesters are required to be a certain distance away from the abortion clinic to keep things safe. Last time I was represented by the ACLU, so the ACLU was really more concerned with the Antifa's rights than mine, and so they could have been putting those kinds of conditions and things, perhaps. It was a very short notice they had to work on, but they didn't do that. So my attorneys are definitely our guys, and they're going to be working to keep these assholes as far away as possible. So it basically comes down to, I don't think that they're going to be near us. They might be throwing bottles and stuff. People need to learn not to overreact to that. Just, you know, you got to be sort of Christ-like in this situation, I do believe. I think that that's going to play well with the normies, is if they see people who are dedicated to their beliefs and are willing to suffer a little bit of abuse. But certainly we don't want it to be abuse where people could actually get hurt. My main concern is just that one of these people, like the Redneck Revolt people, is going to have a gun and try and open fire. That's an issue that has to be dealt with in Virginia. It's an open carry state. You really, as far as I know, don't have a way to restrict these people from bringing guns. I'm going to try to, though. I think that the safest way to do this event is to have it like they did in Shelbyville, where people had to go through a checkpoint. People were complaining, it took so long to get through the checkpoint. I don't care. I don't want anybody hurt. So I think we're going to do a checkpoint either way, to remove all weapons from people on either side. But it's just a question of whether legally we can take away the guns. Now, I would say that the gun issue is not going to be as much of an issue if you were just in the wild and there was a crazy person who wanted to assassinate you. And that's another thing. The main thing they would try and do is assassinate. So I would be at much greater risk of being murdered than anybody else, for instance. But I can tell you from experience with the first Unite the Right that they have federal agents all over the place. There are snipers on the rooftop and so forth. So it would basically be like if an Antifa tried to fire a weapon, they would get executed right away. So I don't think that it would have much of a chance of widespread contagion. So that is what it is. I mean, I just want to be honest with people about what the risks assessment are in my head. That's always going to be there, that Antifa are prepared to use violence, and I think that they're prepared to murder us. But we have to have some people who are willing to put everything on the line for what we believe in.
Yeah, I mean, you really have to be careful about, I mean, if there was another incident like with a car last year, I mean, that would just be a disaster. I mean, I'm not even sure it's recoverable now, but it definitely wouldn't after a second incident. But what do you make? I'm sure you saw a couple of weeks ago, there was that anonymous post on Reddit by a guy who claimed that he had been there, and he made some pretty damning accusations about the mood of the people there and so forth. I'm sure you must have seen that. What's your response to what he wrote?
Well, that guy wasn't actually there. He was claiming to have been one of the organizers, but he wasn't there. He posted a video, and that was from some march against Sharia in Florida that Identity Europa held. This is a guy named Alec, I believe. And yeah, he's part of Identity Europa Florida, or at least he was. And my understanding from people who are in Identity Europa that have told me about this is this guy was kind of wishy-washy to begin with. He was, sort of virtue signaling about different things. But no, he was not an organizer. He was not integral to the movement or to the event. His criticisms might be valid to some extent as far as the culture that exists in the alt-right generally. I mean, I don't want to get into too many specifics on that, but I think that people need to be careful about these chants, like saying things that are just designed to give them an adrenaline rush, which are really edgy. But you can't do that stuff and think that there's not going to be consequences. You need to dial down your rhetoric, because you're just being an emotional spur when you're doing that. Like, my emotion that I want to say this extremely offensive thing is more important than the survival of my people. And it's just not. People need to shut the fuck up with that stuff. They need to stop doing those goddamn salutes and act like professional people. You know, make our ancestors proud, because you know that stuff is not working. And people need to be careful with their private conduct as well. You know, there's a lot of this situation where people just get, like, really fucking drunk and start acting crazy. And you don't think people are going to start filming that stuff and it's going to be released? What happens when we get somebody who's a Paul Nealon type who gets elected? What happens when one of our people becomes a congressman? You want to destroy their life because of your private conduct? I really think we need to reform that a whole lot. We need to be a pro-white civil rights movement that's focused on fixing the demographics issue and fair treatment of our people. But we don't need to be Nazi LARPers.
No, I mean, the goal of all this for all of us should be, I mean, we're trying to get average Americans on our side and not be something that's going to strike them as strange or repulsive. And I think some people just kind of get off on sort of the badassery of the whole thing, and they forget, that's not what we're about. We're trying to be a positive force for ordinary Americans.
Yeah, I mean, there's room to have fun and be offensive online, especially. You have a sock account and you want to, test the boundaries of public discourse. But when you're in public, there is a different standard for things. You need to hold yourself to a higher standard, because this is about winning. And we're not going to win with that kind of behavior.
That is well said. Jason, I think we should wrap it up. We've been going for more than an hour now. I think when we edit out the little intro bits and stuff like that, we'll be right about an hour. So are there any final thoughts you'd like to say about all this?
No, I think I've pretty much said everything. Just, if people can contribute, I certainly have a lot of expenses related to this whole thing and to my creative efforts. Check out that maker support link. You can also follow my website, jasonkessler.us. I break a lot of big news first there. I got the scoop on the Antifa member who pointed the gun at James Fields prior to the car accident. They can follow me on Gab and Twitter. Both of those, I'm at The Mad Dimension. And you can also find my public profile on Facebook.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. This has been really enlightening to me, and I hope the audience as well. Mike, John, do you have any last thoughts before we wrap up?
I was just curious. I hadn't heard about this guy who pointed a gun at James Fields. What's the story? You just gave a reference, but maybe if you could just briefly explain what that's about.
Yeah. I mean, for the full context, I would encourage people to go to my website, jasonkessler.us, and check it out. It was covered by some other news outlets after I broke it. It was covered by InfoWars and Gateway Pundit, for instance. But essentially what happened is I have a local group, which I call New Byzantium, and I can expand that if people want to be local captains. But we focus on investigating the stuff that happened around Unite the Right, and we focus on activism and outreach and so forth. And I've got one guy who goes by the name Jack Corbin, and you can find him on Gab. I either goes by Jack Corbin or Pale Horse, one of the two. And basically his thing is he's a Nazi hunter. I mean, not Nazi hunter, I got that backwards. Antifa hunter. So he goes around and he doxes these Antifas and he follows their social media. And he sends me a lot of stuff that I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that's interesting, but I don't know how I can use that. And he sent me one thing that was just so, like, my eyes just about popped out of my head. He sent me this screenshot that was posted of this Dwayne Dixon, a leader of Redneck Revolt, where he claimed to have chased James Fields with a rifle just prior to the crash. So the context was that this arms manufacturer called Spikes Tactical had put up a viral ad with some pretty cool artwork. It shows these militia looking guys carrying the Spikes equipment, and they're behind these barricades, and there's these legions of black clad Antifa coming towards them, and it says "Not Today Antifa." And it says Charlottesville, Berkeley, Boston, and some other place on it. So the Antifas got really triggered by that. And this guy, Dwayne Dixon, decided he would be really sassy by saying that he himself carried a Spikes Tactical lower to Charlottesville. He said, "I take perverse pleasure in knowing I carried a Spikes Tactical lower to Charlottesville to defend Justice Park. I chased away James Fields just moments before the, what he called the car attack." So that was very interesting to me, because James Fields' defense argument is essentially that he feared for his life or bodily safety. That would be the rationale that you would need to have justification to drive through a crowd of protesters. So if somebody's pointing an AR-15 at your car, that might cause some fear for your life or bodily safety. And the other thing is right, I put a map up in the article on my website where I show just how close the point that Dwayne Dixon was and where he allegedly pointed this gun at James Fields to the crash site. It's like two blocks on the same street on a one-way street. So, and then couple that with the fact that somebody clearly hit James Fields' vehicle from behind with a very large weapon, and then clearly at least one other person hit his vehicle from the side, from the passenger side, with a weapon. So don't you think that might sound like a gunshot if somebody's hitting a car with a very large bat-looking object?
Yeah, this is very interesting. This is something for another conversation, I think, though. So this does provide some context, and I sure hope that James Fields' lawyers are all over this. So, Jason, thank you so much. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and let's do this again.
Sure.
Yeah, thanks a lot.